Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
You know, sometimes it's a good day to die. Sometimes it's a good day to have breakfast.
That's Thomas Builds the Fire, the chatty Kurtelane storyteller from the hit movie Smoke Signals. He's the creation of writer Sherman Alexie, a Spokane Kurtelane Indian himself. Alexie is in his early 30s and already has a small mountain of writings to his credit, the screenplay to Smoke Signals, as well as poetry, novels, and the new short story collection, The Toughest Indian in the World. Alexie specializes in smashing stereotypes. Let's put it this way. There are no stoic warriors in his world. His urban Indians eat at IHOP, go on road trips, and dream about Michael Jordan. Sherman Alexie has a lot in common with Thomas Builds the Fire. He considers himself a storyteller. He told Steve Paulson this one from a tale called South by Southwest.
Seymour didn't want money, he wanted love. So he stole a pistol from the hot plate old man living in the next apartment, then drove over to the International House of Pancakes, the one on 3rd, and ordered everybody to lie down on the floor. The lunch hour crowd did exactly as they were told. This was the International House of Pancakes, and its patrons were used to such things. In control, and because he wanted to be charming and memorable, Seymour kicked open the door to the kitchen and told the cooks to keep flipping the pancakes and pressing the waffles to make sure the bacon and eggs didn't burn and keep the coffee fresh. This was Spokane, Washington, and he wanted the local newspapers to give him a name. Seymour wanted to be the gentleman bandit. He wanted to be the man with scotch tape wrapped around his broken heart. He was a white man, and therefore he was allowed to be romantic. This ain't gonna take long, Seymour said to the cooks, and when it does end, everybody is still going to be hungry. Seymour stood on top of a table. All of his life he dreamed about standing on a table in the International House of Pancakes. He wondered if he would be remembered. He wanted to be potentially dangerous. Put your faces down, shouted Seymour to the diners, whose faces were already down. He said, I want you to put your lips on the floor and tell me what it tastes like. He felt like he was capable of anything, like he might have to buy some bullets for his stolen pistol. The money's in the safe! The money's in the safe! Shouted one of the waitresses, but Seymour didn't need his life to become more difficult than it already was. He didn't want $1,000 or even $1,000,000. All I want is $1 from each of you, said Seymour. He said, I know how hard it is to live in these depressed times. I just want a little bit of your hard-earned money. He wanted to be kind. From the floor, everybody held up a George Washington. On top of those human stems, the green bills blossomed and bloomed. Good, good, said Seymour as he walked through the garden of money and collected $42. Now, what I need, he said, what I need is somebody to run with me. Where are you going? Asked one of the cooks, a man who brought his favorite spatula to work and carried it back home at the end of every shift. Arizona, said Seymour, and the crowd oohed and awed. He knew that everybody loves Arizona because Arizona is potentially dangerous. A man could strap a pistol to his hip and walk unmolested through the streets of Phoenix. But I need somebody to go with me, said Seymour. He said, I aim to go on a nonviolent killing spree, and I need somebody who will fall in love with me along the way. From the floor, a fat Indian man raised his hand. He wore black sweatpants and a white t-shirt embossed with a photograph of Geronimo. I'll go with you, said the fat Indian. Are you gay? Said Seymour. I'm not gay. Are you gay? No, sir. I am not homosexual, but I do believe in love. Seymour thought about that for 5 seconds, and then he asked, You're an Indian, ain't you? Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Do you have a problem with that? Only if you're one of those buffalo hunters. I can't have a nomad in my car. You just can't trust a nomad. I come from a salmon tribe, and therefore I am a dependable man. Well then, you're going with me.
Seymour then names his companion Salmon Boy, and they do kind of fall in love. They,
yeah.
In a very chaste way, though. But they tell each other secrets. They even kiss. They hold each other in bed. Where did you come up with this story?
I'm an insomniac. And one night, 4 a.m, couldn't sleep, you know, and the worst thing to do is laying in bed. So I got up and I go to the International House of Pancakes. And I went there and I was sitting there and I was drinking coffee and reading a magazine when this Indian guy and this white guy walked in. And they were a little intoxicated, but not obnoxious. They're actually pretty funny and charming and fairly quiet. And they sat in the corner. And I don't think they were lovers. They didn't have that kind of energy, but they were obviously very close, best friends, spend a lot of time together. And they were so good together and so funny, and they were making me laugh so much. And I never interacted with them whatsoever that I thought, oh, these guys need a story. These guys need a story. So I got out my notebook right there and started writing it.
Now, what happens in that story is Seymour and Salmon Boy end up, they go on this little trip.
A nonviolent killing spree.
There's very little killing involved, yes.
There's no killing involved.
Right. And they end up robbing a McDonald's in Tucson. And at one point, they stand up on a table together, holding hands. And you write, they were men in love with the idea of being in love. And then as the cops are drawing their guns, they run outside. It's a transcendent moment, of sort of a very idealistic moment, but one that's about to crash into hard reality.
Well, maybe. You know, I stole that ending from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, actually.
And I'm assuming you stole the title from Hitchcock's movie,
North by Northwest, with Cary Grant. And the idea of a nonviolent killing spree with two people falling in love along the way isn't, you know, it's age-old Hollywood story. I mean, Badlands, Natural Born Killers, the idea of this killing spree, and it was so I really played with a lot of sort of American icons and iconography about and these cinema symbols and these cultural symbols, but I wanted to mix it all up by having it be this, you know, homoerotic love story between two straight guys.
And that's, I suppose, what you're out to do in a lot of these stories is to bust boundaries.
Yeah, especially, well, most of the stories are about sex. You know, my mom read the book, you know, recently. She got, you know, she called me up and she said, are you okay?
You have a little obsession here?
And I said, what? And she goes, well, there's a lot of doing it in these books. And I said, doing what? I knew what she meant, but I said, doing what? And she goes, you know, having the sex. And she said that, having the sex. And I said, yeah. She goes, well, why are you writing about that now? You never wrote about it before. And I said, well, it's not because I just started having it, Mom. But I said, I'm trying to bust stereotypes because Indians in popular culture, movies, books, anywhere, Indians do not get to have sex. And so I wrote one story with that idea in mind. Well, I'm going to let some Indians have good sex. Good sex. Just plain, straight good sex. Having fun. A good sex story about... And then it just continued from there because it was so fun to write it.
And in your stories, the Indians are often married to white people.
Yeah, you know, because there's been some instances of white people and Indians having sex.
That has happened.
Yeah, so it has occurred. You know, I've seen it.
Let me ask you about one of your stories, Class, which has a rich Indian lawyer named Edgar Eagle Runner. He marries...
that's the name he has. He uses. His real name is Edgar Joseph.
He marries a white woman, and their marriage starts going on the rocks after a while.
And it's his fault. Let's put that perfectly clear. It's his fault. He's a jerk,
and he ends up wanting to kind of become a little more Indian or have more contact with the Indian culture. He tries hiring an Indian hooker, although it turns out she's just a white woman dressed up in an Indian costume. And then he stumbles into an Indian bar.
What he's doing is trying to be the kind of Indian he thinks he's supposed to be. So he's buying into these sort of stereotypical images, thinking, well, if I sleep with an Indian woman, then I'm more Indian. If I go to an Indian bar, then I'm more Indian. And he ends up in this Indian bar, actually ends up in a fight with this Indian street brawler, and thinks that's this warrior thing starts getting into him because.
And he could walk out. I mean, he could avoid that, but he actually.
In fact,
he chooses to have this.
The tough Indian actually encourages him to leave, gives him every opportunity to leave, and he keeps going for it. He wants to fight. You know, he's thinking deep in the story it talks about, and deep in the heart of every Indian man's heart, he thinks he's Crazy Horse.
And as he rushes towards this guy, right before he gets pounded,
knocked into unconsciousness, and gets his nose broken and one of his braids cut off, and wakes up that way, and ends up sort of in this bloody epiphany. I don't know if he understood what it meant, but certainly the Indian woman, the bartender who's nursing him, certainly understands that. You know, as she says, I mean, you know, we want your life. What are you doing here? We want your life.
Now you have, to some degree, moved into the white world. I mean, you've certainly...
I've always been in the white world.
Okay.
All Indians are always in the white world. See, that's the amazing thing people don't understand. I mean, regardless of my blood level of Indianness or how Indian I am, I'm also white because I every minute of my life is spent in the white culture.
Do you worry about becoming too white?
No, no. I mean,
that's not even an issue.
No, I mean, I could change in the middle of a sentence. You know, if there was an Indian in the room, I could have the same conversation with both of you, and the meaning would be different simply if I changed the inflection of a word or two. It would change. No, that's what I'm tired of the dysfunctional model of Indian life, that it's somehow difficult to walk in two worlds. I'm tired of it. It's self-fulfilling prophecy. It's not difficult. We do it all the time. And I've accepted that it's easy, and I love it. I love being Indian American because it means I have two incredible, wonderful, awful, magical, terrible traditions to work from.
There's a story about your first bookstore reading in Seattle.
Well, it wasn't my first bookstore reading.
Oh, that's what I'd heard.
It was my first reading in Seattle.
Okay.
It was my first reading in Seattle, and I knew nobody knew who I was or what I looked like or just had a vague idea of what I looked like. I expected to see some, you know, tall, skinny college graduate Indian dude. So what I did was dress up in a slimy trench coat and messed my hair up and I don't drink. I didn't drink then, but I put some, I got a beer and I spread beer on me so I would smell like beer. And I came staggering in. I let the reading be about 10 minutes late. People were getting kind of uncomfortable. And then I staggered in about 10 minutes, acting like a drunk Indian. But that has the accent gone down, acting like Lester Falls Apart, one of my characters, and staggered in yelling, "Where's that? I heard there's an Indian poet. He's not Indian. Indians don't write poems." So I was doing this whole performance bit and, you know, shocking everybody. And I remember people were trying to, a couple guys stood up and were trying to pull me out. And I got to the stage finally, and I stood up there and I was yelling and screaming. And under the coat, I had a suit on, suit and tie. And I sort of spun around and threw it off and started speaking in my urban Indian voice. And people sort of were stunned by that. So I could never do that again, though. I could never do that again.
You're too famous now.
It's so fun. I knew even if I did, after I did it once, I could never do it again. I mean, I did Lester again, the character, but everybody knew I was playing Lester.
But clearly performance is something that matters to you. I mean, it's not just what you put on the page.
No, I mean, it's really important to me. I mean, it was so funny. It's so important to me. And you're getting such a reputation for it that the New York Times Book Review of my book by Joanna Scott really sort of lambasted me for this, you know, and said the book was just a script, you know, for Sherman's performances. It was hilarious and so elitist, you know. It was so, so threatened by the idea that a writer could be popular or have some sort of influence in pop culture or play in pop culture. And yeah, it's vital. Performance is vital. I mean, somehow or another, writers have forgotten that we're storytellers. They like to pretend about their traditions and where they come from, but we're storytellers, we're entertainers. 100 years ago, I would have been sitting in the teepee. People would have been dropping whole salmon into my mouth. I would have weighed 900 pounds. I would have been Jabba the Indian. And that would have been who I was. And that's who I am now. I'm a traveling flute player. That's what I am.
Let me ask you about the movie that you did, Smoke Signals, which is based on your stories. It's been billed as the first movie that's ever been not only about Indians, but made by Indians.
Well, it's the first feature film written, directed, produced by Indians, starring Indians as Indians to ever be distributed.
What were you trying to do with that film?
Make a movie. I mean, really, make a movie. I just wanted to make a movie. I love movies. And the fact remains that I knew that every Indian in this country would see the thing eventually. And I would say, by now, 99% of Indians in the United States have seen Smoke Signals. It's gotten to the point where I can't walk anywhere where Indians are and not hear, "Hey, Victor, what about your dad?" You know, hearing dialogue from the movie. One of the stars of the film, Michelle St. John, was at a conference in Canada recently speaking. And as she was speaking, a bunch of teenage Indian girls in the crowd stood up and ripped their fry bread in half, which is another scene from the film, and they did it spontaneously. I mean, they'd planned it, but she didn't know it was going to happen. But
you're also saying that that film couldn't have, and maybe this is such an obvious question that it's stupid, but that film couldn't have been made by people who weren't Indians.
Oh, impossible. 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 That film couldn't have been made by anybody but me. You know, I mean, it, you know, that's what I hated when they talk, "Oh, it has universal values." No, it didn't. It came from one goofy, eccentric Spokane Indian boy. It sprung from my head. And the reason why it was good or bad or interesting or boring, and all that springs from the fact that it was out of my head, and that's what makes it what it is. Good art is very eccentric and specific. Good art is not universal. Bruce Willis is universal. Godzilla is universal. Good art is tribal. It's always very tribal.
What about white people who take on the trappings of Indian culture, beating drums, building sweat lodges, putting dream catchers above their beds? Do you have a problem
with
that?
Well, basically what it comes down to is the New Age movement was just another way that white guys invented to get laid. That's all it comes down to. The whole Hemingway-esque macho guy thing had quit working because women had gotten tired of it. So guys got around. We had a meeting, and guys said, we need to come up with something new. How about this sensitive thing? How about this going back to the earth thing? That'll work. We'll grow our hair in ponytails. We'll drum. That'll really get them. It's really stupid above all else. And the last stage of the colonial process is when the colonizers completely absorb the culture of the colonized and make them disappear. And in this country, at this late stage of the colonial war, it is liberals, it is lefties who are the last soldiers against Indians. And they'd be aghast to think that or to hear that. And I'm sure they are aghast and all angry at me for saying it. But the fact remains is that the last soldiers, the last fight right now in the colonial war is Indians versus New Age liberals.
Who's going to win?
Oh, Indians, always. My grandma always used to tell me, we were here before they all got here and we'll be here after they're all gone. But we'll keep some of you around, the cool ones. The thing is, I love white people. I love European-American culture. I love European culture. There's so much greatness that comes out of it. Why would you turn your back on it? See, what it is New Age people and people who drop into this Indian thing or Buddhist thing or things outside of their culture, they're doing it out of a self-hatred, a self-loathing. They're turning their back on their culture because of its perceived evil. But the fact remains is that all cultures are a mix of magic and loss, and they're turning their back on who they are. So they're literally giving up their identity.
Sherman Alexie writes and eats at the International House of Pancakes in Seattle. His latest collection of short stories is The Toughest Indian in the World. Steve Paulson talked with him.